My name is Isaac Sanborn. I'm the youth director at Church of All Nations here. Thank you. I'm sharing the meditation time with Pastor Jim Bear, who is much more qualified and well-spoken than me in every way. But, you know, this is a church where we have, like, high-risk, low-anxiety, so that's what I'm doing. Trying to keep the anxiety down and the risk high. Yeah. So we have a slideshow. Inkyung, if you could show that. I'm going to share a bit about the Dakota Access Pipeline. We had a group of 10 people from our church drive out to Standing Rock this past weekend. I wish I had spoken with some of them before sharing today. That will happen later. This is a map of where the pipeline is supposed to go. It's over 1,000 miles long, and it's supposed to transport over 400,000 barrels of oil a day, just massive amounts of oil. There are all kinds of pipelines underground, like this one, in our country, that have been protested and usually eventually built. This one is different for a number of reasons. I mean, last year there was the Keystone Pipeline that got protested and halted. This one has a lot of interesting background. If you could go to the next slide, please. I want to go way back in history for a moment. Who can tell me what was discovered in California in 1849? Gold, very good. Y'all are smart. In 1849, gold was discovered in California. Up until that point, the West was seen by the U.S. government as permanent Indian frontier. No reason to go west. It's just a wasteland. It's very hard to live there. And we can see that in Las Vegas today. It's like a desert, basically. But if you find gold, you got to get there as fast as you can. And that's when prospectors started heading west. And what they crossed was the homeland of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Native Americans trying to get there as fast as they could. And at first, this was, you know, alarming, but not super alarming to Native Americans. There's just like kind of a trickle of people that they've never met before going and saying, "We're going to try to find gold." You do that. Good luck. But what was happening at the time in the area is there's just like kind of back and forth. There's a whole bunch of different tribes living in the middle of the continent, and occasionally there are wars between the tribes. And so the settlers, as they were crossing America, saw what they thought was like terrifying, just barbaric behavior happening, and decided that they needed protection from the U.S. Army. So that they could cross safely. And so now it was not only settlers crossing the continent, but forts were starting to be built. Fort Snelling was built here in Minnesota around that time, basically to provide safe passage to white settlers who felt threatened as they were crossing the country. And so in 1851, if you could actually go back to the slide. Oh, this is it. Yep, 1851. There was a treaty called the Fort Laramie Treaty, and it basically divided up massive territories for each tribe in basically North America. So this is a map of the Lakota Territory. There's also Arikara Territory, Crow Territory, all different kinds of like Cheyenne territories on the map, basically saying, you stay here, and you stay here, and don't look at each other until I say you can. Which is really arbitrary, very strange concept. And the people who signed this treaty were just a handful of individuals that the U.S. government selected from each tribe, saying, you're going to be our representative, sign here, it's all good, thanks. This lasted for a while, this treaty, and basically it said that the U.S. could build forts and roads through the territories as long as each tribe received $50,000 a year for 50 years. It's a pretty good deal. But again, not everyone was on the same page about this. So hundreds of thousands of Native Americans who didn't sign the treaty all of a sudden are seeing these forts being built, these roads being built, way more volume of settlers coming through trying to get to gold. And it's a massive intrusion on their way of life. They can't continue with their sustainable way that they've been doing since as far as they can remember. It's this incursion onto their survival, because the land can't hold that many people all at once. So they protested and said, hey, actually, this isn't going to work for us, and I don't know who signed that treaty, but it wasn't us. And so for about 10 years, from 1865 to 1876, there were a number of wars between the Lakota people and the U.S. government trying to figure this thing out. So we can go to the next slide, please. There was a chief named Red Cloud, who in 1868 won a war against the U.S. military. This is not often remembered. We often think of Native Americans as a conquered people, but the fact is that the U.S. was conquered by Red Cloud in 1868. And there was a treaty signed at that time, basically, that the Lakota could have undisturbed use and occupation of their land, and that this gold nonsense needs to stop. This area included the Black Hills. In 1874, Colonel Custer, with some geologists, discovered gold in the Black Hills. Before, they were just trying to get to California. But now there's gold literally right there, right within their reach. And so in 1877, the U.S. Army seized the Black Hills, which was completely illegal. And so I wanted to take a step back and talk about this thing that I learned about in Palestine called facts on the ground, which basically, in Palestine, Israel will, bulldozers, construction companies, and settlers will bulldoze an area where there was previously life going on, and then quick build a highway or a house or like a massive building. And then before legal action can happen, they will get a fact on the ground, which it's argued they can't unbuild. And so it may be illegal, but it's just a fact of life now. So we have to adjust the laws to meet the facts on the ground. This is the way that the U.S. has done treaties in this country. There are laws, but then there are facts on the ground. So there was the 1868 treaty, which lasted up until they discovered gold in the treaty area, and then we need that gold, so the treaty goes out the window, and we need to come up with a new system, just adjust to these facts on the ground. If you could go to the next slide, please. So the facts on the ground kept on getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and the areas where the natives could use undisturbed and sole access of them got smaller and smaller and smaller, until we have these orange modern-day reservations. And you can see the red dot is where Standing Rock is, right on the border with North Dakota and South Dakota. So there's a lot of money behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's a billion-dollar project, $3.5 billion. And the argument to this point from the CEO of Energy Transfer Products is that we've already built over half of the pipeline. We can't stop now. There's facts on the ground. We've already spent $1.5 billion. That's down the drain. It's a fact on the ground. We can't unbuild what we've built. And so these natives who are protesting at Standing Rock, over 100 tribes gathered in one place, these are trying to obstruct our facts on the ground. And they are in the way. They're trespassing on our project, and they must be removed as soon as possible. So there was a court decision in September. There was a long lawsuit, started basically last year in 2015, trying to say the pipeline is illegal in almost every way. It's illegal environmentally, it's illegal based on the archaeological value and the cultural value of all of the artifacts that are in the ground that that they want to excavate for the pipeline. And it's illegal based even on the 1868 treaty. But the district court threw that lawsuit out in September, on September 9th. And at that moment, it's basically a few departments of the executive branch made a joint statement saying, just stop construction until the Army Corps of Engineers can reevaluate the situation, make a better decision. And so it's legally a very tenuous situation, and there's a whole lot of things happening on the ground all at once, one of which is that a huge part of the pipeline has already been built. There's a number of construction sites in Standing Rock where at any given day, the Dakota Access Pipeline people will try to go and continue the project. And these protesters who are saying this is yet again an incursion on our way of life, saying that water is life and this pipeline is threatening water on a very real level and must be stopped. It's not even really about the legality of the situation, because the U.S., like I said, the treaties are only valid in our minds until new facts on the ground emerge. Putting all the legality aside, this is about life. This is about the way of life of a people who have been on this continent for tens of thousands of years and need this thing to stop. So on the next slide, this is there's kind of police that are in Standing Rock. There's also like private security forces, which is kind of another word for that military, the U.S. Army, that originally, back in the 1850s, protected white settlers in an area. It's kind of the same thing playing out right now. It's a very old game. Something needs to happen. There's a militarized force that's sent in to make sure that it happens. And people who are protesting, putting their foot down and saying, this can't happen. This must not happen. That's some of the background to the protest that's happening right now. Just in Standing Rock, there's kind of a concentrated microcosm of hundreds of years of history. I want us to be aware of that. And with that, I'd like to invite Pastor Jim Bear for the remaining time.
Morning, church.
Morning.
I want to thank Isaac for setting some historical background. I asked him to screw up his presentation a little bit so that I would look better in comparison. Just have to work on his obedience and submission to authority. Quick survey of the audience tells me I should introduce myself. We have a number of visitors with us for the first time. Ahu Kulamausi, Ni Dijinji Mak, Jimber Jacobs, Ni Tak Dilangamau, Ni Mihikiniak, Stockbridge Munsi, Inakako Satowa, Kulamausi, Inishik, Inishik, Inishik. I give you greetings this beautiful morning and introduce myself as Jimber Jacobs. I'm a pastor here at Church of All Nations. I also introduce myself as a member of the Turtle Clan of the Mohican Nation, the Stockbridge Munsee Band. And with goodness in my heart, I extend my welcome and my gratitude to you today. Susie, my wife, and I bought a house last December. Previous owners of this house had lived in this house for over 30 years. And in the spring, when the emerging sun melted away the winter's snow, it revealed a yard of this house that had been neglected for maybe the last 10 years, 15 years. We had a number of nuisance trees, just trees that were randomly growing in places that would if allowed to continue, would be an incredible inconvenience and would actually cost us money, as they would ruin fences and wreck foundations of the house and the garage. And they weren't large trees. They had just, you know, maybe 3-4 years old. The largest one was a cedar tree, about the size around of a dinner plate, that had maybe stood for about 15 or 20 years. Because I'm a first-time homeowner and found it my duty to take care of my yard, I went, got the chainsaw, fired it up, and quickly disposed of these half a dozen or so trees. The last one I cut was the cedar tree, the largest one. Not big by any stretch of the imagination, but the largest one to come down. I shut the chainsaw off and I looked around. I was looking for my oldest daughter, my 9-year-old, Raina. See, Raina's always had an incredibly strong connection to the things that God has created. And I looked all around the yard for Raina and I couldn't find her until finally I walked on the back side of the largest cottonwood tree in our yard, her tree, her favorite tree. She had tears streaming down her face. She was literally having her arms wrapped. She couldn't reach her arms around, but wrapped around, holding this tree. With anger and disdain in her eyes and in her voice, she said, "Not this one. You go away. Don't touch this one." She's weeping. I realized I had a teachable moment. I could go one of two ways. I could teach her in this moment about the earth as a resource, as a material object that we have dominion over, and we can exercise that dominion as we see fit. That's how most of us grew up. I could have very easily dismissed her and dismissed these trees with a simple phrase, "Listen, child, they're just trees." But instead, I chose to go a different route. I grabbed my daughter in my arms, and I sat down with her, and I said, "Sweetie, I know this hurts, but the people who lived here before us didn't take care of this yard the way they were supposed to. And if these trees would continue to grow, they wouldn't thrive, and they would hurt our house. And they would wreck the power lines." I said, "We have, our people, we have ceremonies for just these kind of things. And if you'll wait right here, I'll go to my medicine pouch. And I'll get our medicine, I'll get our tobacco. And we'll go around to all these trees. And we'll thank the trees for the life they've lived and the good work they did while standing here. And we'll say we're sorry that we had to take them down. And we'll lay our offering at their stump." She agreed to that, so we did. We went around the whole yard to every stump that now existed where a tree once stood. We laid our tobacco down. We thanked them for the good work that they did, the shade they provided, the cleansing of the air. We said we're sorry. We laid tobacco down. The last one we went to was that cedar tree that had stood for 15 or 20 years. It was sickly. It wasn't going to make it much, many more winters. But still it had value to her. And as we stood over that stump of the cedar tree, we again repeated the ceremony. We thanked it for everything it provided, the good work it did. We said we were sorry. We laid our tobacco down. And I thought we were done, but Raina, you have to know her to fully understand this. Before we leave that stump, she leans down tenderly, cautiously to the stump, and she whispers just loud enough for me to hear, "Just so you know, it was him, not me." Thank you. Last Monday was Indigenous Peoples Day. Because there's not very many of us Indigenous people who do public speaking, it's a busy, busy time for those of us that do. Speaking to you today is actually my 9th public address in the last 7 days. So, you'll excuse me if some of my thoughts and seem a little bit scattered. We are surrounded by water. Where there's water, there's life. And where there's life, there's stories. I often feel a tension in doing the work I do right at the cusp of environmental justice and racial justice. Because it seems that those workers in environmental justice and those workers in racial justice can sometimes be at odds with each other. Not because either side is morally opposed to the goals and desired outcomes of the other side, but because each side is pulling from a limited pool of activists and resources. The thought process being, how can you devote all of this time to clean water and renewable energy when black and brown bodies are being shot in our streets every day? And then from the other side, if we don't fix our clean water and renewable energy crisis, then there will be no bodies anywhere for anyone to shoot or work on. But the protectors who have stationed themselves at Standing Rock, they demonstrate a new way of thinking for us. This thought being that environmental justice and racial justice are intimately tied to each other. In short, environmental justice is racial justice. Here's my thinking behind that. Isaac did a great job of pointing out some of the history of this Dakota Access Pipeline. There's one very interesting fact that he left out. This pipeline that is crossing the Missouri River about half a mile to a mile upriver from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation was not originally engineered to cross the Missouri River at that point. The original design for this pipeline, for this path, called for this Dakota Access Pipeline to cross the Missouri River just upriver from Bismarck, North Dakota. Now, Bismarck is the largest town in North Dakota, the largest city in North Dakota. When the citizens of Bismarck realized that this pipeline was scheduled to cross upriver from them, they understandably were a little bit peeved about this. They made their thoughts known. Then that entire section was re-engineered to cross the Missouri River downriver from Bismarck and just a half mile upriver from the Standing Rock Sioux Lakota Nation. It should be pointed out, does not escape us, that the demographics of Bismarck, North Dakota is it is a 95% white. The demographics of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, we'll call it a 99.9% population. Every once in a while we get a sneak in. What is the subtext that our lies that white lives were too important to inconvenience with the possibility of contaminating their water, but their lives, it's okay. And this is racial justice. Because when these pipelines fail, it is not the entitled white individuals who will shoulder the weight of that burden. It is the poor, it is the disenfranchised, the people of color. This is why in this country it is more tolerable to poison the bodies of black and brown families through their drinking water in Flint, Michigan, than it is for the rich white families in Beverly Hills. We tolerate that. It's why in this country it is more tolerable to endanger the lives of Native Americans than it is for middle-class Bismarck citizens. Environmental justice and racial justice are intimately tied. Environmental justice is racial justice. You see, racial injustice dehumanizes people. Once dehumanized, it is easier to limit, prohibit, and endanger those resources essential for life. This pipeline will fail if allowed to be completed. It will breach. It will break. It will spill its content onto the earth and into the waters. Quick research reveals that just in 2016, just in the last 10 months, and just in the United States, there were over 20 ruptures of pipes spilling well over 1 million gallons of crude oil or petroleum byproducts. This counts the houses that blow up from gas leaks, doesn't the environmental disasters from mining and extracting this oil. This is just the transport of these products through these pipelines. Over 20 ruptures in the last 10 months. The numbers become astronomical if you go back 10 years. And just taking into calculation the number of ruptures just in the 21st century, just in the last 16 years, it's almost uncountable. It doesn't need to be this way. Doesn't need to be this way. Right now across Canada, there are 93 Native communities that are under do not drink your water bans. They have to spend an incredible amount of money and resources bringing in bottled water or going through the task of boiling their water before it's suitable for human consumption. 93 Native communities. That's not including British Columbia. In British Columbia, just this year on August 4th, an open pit mine owned appropriately enough by the Imperial Metals Corporation. Because if you're going to exploit the earth, just name it, you're Imperial. The Imperial Metals Corporation open pit poly mine. If you know anything about open pit mining, you have to contain your waste product in what's called a tailings pond. Tailings pond is just another large open pit that they put in their sludge water that is just completely polluted with their byproducts of their mining process. It's filled with incredible heavy metals that is toxic to the environment. On August 4th, that tailings mine breached, spilling an estimated 4 billion gallons of toxic sludge into the surrounding waterways. Waterways that were pristine, prime waterways for salmon migration and spawning. If you know anything about the indigenous peoples of British Columbia, their entire culture and way of life surrounds the salmon run. And in this section, 4 billion gallons of poison now dumped into their precious salmon waters. They can't drink their water. They can't catch their fish. They can't continue with their traditional way of life. In our text today, John the Revelator saw a vision of the river of God, which contained the water of life, flowed from the throne of God, that brought life to the trees along its banks, the trees bearing fruit that should be for the healing of all nations. Some of you were worried when you saw our text was Revelation today because you undoubtedly, like me, come from an evangelical background and you know that Revelation is the dumbest book that a preacher could ever preach on. No one understands Revelation. No one gets it. Simple primer for understanding Revelation is John is ticked off at the empire and he's dreaming of a post-imperial world. Today, that river of life flows from the throne of God, that waters the trees that bear fruit for the healing of nations. That river flows through North Dakota, just outside the Standing Rock Reservation. If we do not get a hold of this, if we do not turn our ways, if we do not divorce ourselves from the empire of greedy capitalist energy companies who would exploit our resources, not theirs, ours, and endanger our people, our most vulnerable populations, if we don't do that, then there is no hope for us. Because where there is water, there is life. And where there is life, there is stories. If we contaminate our water, it will cease to be life-giving. And when it ceases to be life-giving, quickly our stories will fade. How many generations are we away from our grandchildren or our great-grandchildren? Taking a look around, surveying the situation that they've inherited, and tenderly leaning down to the earth, to the water, saying, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It was them, not me. Gracious God, you have given us this earth and all she provides as a relative, and we have sought to conquer her, to dominate her, to exploit. We ask your forgiveness. We ask that you would guide us and show us how to live in a right way, how to walk gently, how to imagine a future for our children where the river of life flows and the nations are healed. And we who are born from this land, the indigenous people of this land, we know that it is our voice that is so necessary in these times. So I lift up on this week of Indigenous Peoples Day, all of my Indigenous sisters and brothers. Strengthen their legs to stand, strengthen their hands to act, and strengthen their voices to call out the injustice that threatens us all. We pray this with all of our relatives. Unishi, aho, mitakwesim.